Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you tonight by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, headquarters for personal loans, conveniently located on Main Street in Cromwell. Here's your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me is radio collector Ed Corcoran. And Ed, we have a giant of giants of the radio industry with us tonight.
Yeah, we keep coming up with them, Dick. We've had a senator, we've had a lawyer, now we have a doctor, Dr. Arnold Moss.
Dr. Arnold Moss, it's a pleasure indeed to welcome you to the Golden Age of Radio. Arnold, I want to find out about that doctorate degree. When did you receive it?
Well, I think you'd better explain what kind of a doctorate it is. If you don't feel so good, don't call me. It's a doctor of philosophy, which I got in theater at New York University last June.
Well, you must be very proud of that, and you had the opportunity to acquire it because you were working steadily at one location for a while, which is very difficult for an actor.
That's right. I was in Follies, Hal Prince's Follies, and I knew that it was going to run somewhere between a year and 2 years, and I thought that it would afford me the luxury of going back to school and dropping the other shoe that I had not dropped 30 years before. I had done all my work toward the doctorate 30 years before when I had taught at Brooklyn College in between other things, and I went back and did it.
You know, Ed, the voice of Arnold Moss is familiar to radio listeners today because he's on the CBS Mystery Theater, but it goes back a long time before that.
Yes, I'm sure that well, he's among my earliest voices I remember because, and it's still as vibrant today as it was then, Dick. There's no change that I can detect. It's still Arnold Moss, and it's not it's a young Arnold Moss as far as the voice is concerned. It hasn't aged a bit.
Well, tell me, Arnold, did you sound as mellifluous when you were a CBS announcer back in the early 30s as you do today? Or did your voice change?
I don't know. It hasn't changed. Right now it's a little tired because I'm rehearsing in Lear, but up here at UConn, but I don't know that it's ever been more or less mellifluous because I've never been aware of the quality of my voice. My whole theory is, and I think you would both agree with me, that as soon as an actor or announcer becomes aware of the mellifluousness of his voice, he better go out and get himself another job because he's not paying attention to what he's saying, but rather how it sounds.
You were 18 when you first got into radio. Where?
In New York, at CBS, I won some kind of a competition. Ken Roberts and I were hired at the same time by CBS and stayed on for a year or two until the Depression caught up with everybody. And then CBS fired 10% of everybody, from vice presidents down to bootblacks. And I was one of the last people hired, and I lost my job. It didn't matter because radio drama began to happen at that time, and I became one of the regulars on the very first March of Time that ever was, along with, they're all dead now, people like Ted DeCorsia and Ed Jerome, and there were Arlene Francis and Agnes Moorehead, and We got paid very, very well. We got paid $50 a week for the March of Time, where everybody else was getting $5 for doing the soaps. And it was a whole week. We just sat there. And I did the very first programs that were ever done on an experimental basis, the Columbia Workshop, with dear Irving Reese, who was an engineer who became a director and invented things that we now don't even think about, like the echo chamber and a filter. There was no such thing as a filter. A telephone conversation was done by putting a glass up to your mouth. You're both too young to remember that. but these were not only the golden days of radio, they were the first days of radio where whatever you did was everybody was doing for the first time, and the whole thing was a business of a discovery of techniques and how you approach this silly thing called a microphone, how you played to it rather than to another person. As a matter of fact, I gave a course here last semester on the contrasting techniques, the comparative techniques of the actor in various media. Fortunately, I've worked in all of them, so that if you're doing a stage play and you now do it for film, your techniques are different. If you're doing it for tape, for videotape, it's different. If you're doing it in a non-visual medium like radio, it's again different. And that's a course that I invented and was very successful.
You perhaps are just a bit confused if you're listening to us and don't realize that we're doing the show from the University of Connecticut, where Dr. Arnold Moss is teaching. And Ed, I think it's about time that we heard Arnold Moss in performance.
Yes, I have an early excerpt. This was from that soap opera. What was the name of it? Stella Dallas. Right, that's the one.
I remember it.
I wasn't sure whether you want to hear that one again, because this is kind of a corny little bit about a mummy being lost and something like that. But you're right in there very prominently. Would you like to hear that again, Arnold?
I'd love to hear it.
Sheikh Ahmed? Is that...
I think I played two parts. I played Sheikh Ahmed and his twin brother or something. This is a long time ago. I don't remember it. I've done a few things since. That's fantastic.
And now for our sequel to Stella Dallas. In Washington with her daughter Laurel and Laurel's husband Dick Grosvenor, Stella Dallas is falsely accused by Dick's mother, Mrs. Grosvenor, of stealing an Egyptian mummy. Stella, however, through Jeff Kentrell, an underworld acquaintance of Stella's old admirer, Ed Munn, discovers the real thief to be Rashid, the twin brother of her friend Sheikh Ahmed, whom Mrs. Grosvenor is sponsoring in society. And Stella upsets Rashid's scheme to get $15,000 from Mrs. Grosvenor. To save Ahmed's family honor and avoid embarrassment for Mrs. Grosvenor, Stella agrees to keep the matter a secret upon Rashid's promise that he will keep out of their way in the future. Now it's the next night in Lowell's apartment, and Stella is having after-dinner coffee with Lowell and Dick.
Well, Stella, how does it feel to be back with Lowell and me in our apartment?
Oh, it's just swell, Dick.
Oh, Mommy, it makes me so happy that you're staying here with us instead of at that hotel. I never would have let you go there in the first place if it weren't... Well, it's...
I know, Lolly. You're thinking about the little misunderstanding you and I had coming down from New York on the train.
Well, yes, I was. But that's all cleared up. And now I'm never going to let you go again.
I still feel kind of guilty about taking that room away from Baby Jones' nurse.
Oh, you didn't take it away from her, Stella. It's your room, and it always has been.
Of course, Mommy. And anyway, I'd really rather have a nurse sleeping in the same room with Jones.
Oh, both of you are sure doing everything you can to make me feel welcome.
I guess you don't realize what an important person you are to everybody, Stella. Why, Mother's singing your praises from the housetop.
Why shouldn't she? After Mommy saved her from giving $15,000 to Rashid. I'm sure nobody but you, Mommy, could ever have discovered that Rashid was Ahmed's twin brother.
We all thought Rashid was Ahmed.
Yes, but you didn't know Ahmed had a twin brother, and I did. And if I hadn't remembered that Rashid's accomplice, Jeff Cantrell, was an acquaintance of Ed Munn's, I'd probably never have found out the truth.
Well, Rashid's out of the way now, and we'll probably never hear from this man Cantrell.
I don't think so either, Dick, although Ed Munn's scared that he might.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, but that's only because Cantrell has this bad check of Ed's and has been threatening Ed.
Oh, there's the front door buzzer. I wonder who in the world can be calling on us this evening.
I hope the maid tells whoever it is we're not in. I'd like the three of us to have just a quiet evening at home tonight.
Yeah.
Hey, Del!
Oh,
where are you?
It's Ed Munn.
He sounds pretty boisterous to me.
Shall we let him in?
Hey, Del! Come and tell this. Maybe it's okay for me to come in.
I better go out of Lolly. He'll never go away without seeing me.
Hey, Steph!
Come in, Ed.
Why did you tell Stella to bring him in here, Laurel? It sounds as if he's been drinking.
Maybe he has, darling, but after all, he is a friend of Mommy's.
I don't think Stella's any more anxious to have him around here than we are.
They've always been good friends, you know.
I thought that was all washed up. Why did Stella have to bring him here to Washington in the first place? She should have let him stay in New York.
Well, if it hadn't been for Ed Munn, we'd never have found where this man Cantrell was holding Ahmed a prisoner in New York. And when he told Mommy he was scared of what Cantrell might do to him, Mommy had to let him come back here with us.
Oh, just the same, dear, I think...
Well, Lolly. Oh, I'm glad to see you.
Hello, Mr. Mon.
Oh, hello, Dick. Hiya, boy.
Hello.
I'm awful sorry, Dick, but...
Sorry? So what are you sorry about, Stella? Ain't nothing to be sorry about.
Won't you sit down, Mr. Mon?
Yeah, I say I don't care if I do. Say, I better sit down before I fall down. Hey, say, what's everybody looking so solemn about? This ain't no time to look solemn.
Here, Eddie, you better have some coffee.
Coffee? Say, what's the idea?
Go ahead, drink it. It'll do you good.
Hey, Stella, I spent $2 to get this way, and I ain't going to spoil it with no black coffee.
Oh, why'd you do it, Ed?
Oh, I just had to have a little celebration tonight. But after this, I'm through.
I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, yes. I'm going to make something out of myself. I'm going to settle down here in Washington and make something out of myself.
Aren't you going back to New York, Mr. Mann?
Oh, I can't go back to New York. If I go back there, Kent will bum me off.
Ed, you mean you're going to live in Washington from now on?
Sure thing you know, Stella, old girl. I'm going to settle down here and make something out of myself.
Well, if you're going to make something out of yourself, Ed, don't you think it'd be a good idea to start behaving yourself right away?
Now, I told you, it's just the last little fling after the night. Finish.
But you're not serious about staying in Washington, are you?
Well, I can't do nothing else, Dick. Cantrell'd kill me sure if I went back to New York.
Oh, that's a lot of hooey, Ed. Guess Cantrell ain't bothering about nothing except keeping out of the way of the police. He thinks they're looking for him for kidnapping Armin.
Yeah, well, he ain't going to think that after seeing Rashid.
How do you know Rashid's going to see Cantrell?
Sure he's going to see him. Say, listen, Stella, I bet those two have got their heads together right now. I'll bet Rashid's gone to New York and is talking to Cantrell this very minute.
Well, Rashid, so it was the Stella Dallas dame who got Edmund to let your brother out of his flat and upset all our plans.
Yes, Jeff. And I'll never forget, just as Madame Grosvenor was about to sign the check, Stella Dallas walked through the door.
And 15 grand flew out of the window. I needed my cut of that 15 grand, Rashid. I needed it bad.
No more than I did, Jeff.
You? You'd have thrown it away in a month.
And I suppose you, my dear Cantrell, would have given your share to some deserving charity.
Never mind what I'd have done with my share. A punk like you can never understand.
Indeed? And may I ask why...
Keep it. Needling each other won't get that 15,000. I'm just plain jinxed this year. My luck shot.
Oh, come, come. We're both extremely lucky to have escaped so lightly. Unpleasant as it is to have lost Mrs. Grosvenor's money... It would be even more unpleasant to be facing life in prison.
How do I know I won't be facing it yet?
They cannot touch you without involving me. And as I've already explained, my brother Ahmed knows that if I were tried, he would have to testify against me.
That ought to be a pleasure for him.
You forget that I am his brother, his twin. The ties of blood mean much to Ahmed. As much as he hates me, he feels it his duty to protect me.
Okay. But what about the others?
They are as anxious as Ahmed to keep the whole matter quiet. The trial would mean that Mrs. Grosvenor would be exposed to the world as the fool she is, which would not only be disagreeable for her, but also embarrassing to her son.
He's the one that's married to the dame you were trying to make time with, isn't he?
Yes, Mr. Grosvenor's a young man with a brilliant future, I understand. He's employed in the banking firm of Mason and Company.
Arthur Mason? The big shot banker?
Yes, and Mason is pushing Mr. Grosvenor ahead very rapidly. Would hardly help his career to have his mother made a public laughingstock.
I guess it wouldn't. Don't sound like a bad place to work, Mason's outfit.
Are you thinking of applying for a position?
Anybody could do worse than work for Mason. A guy like him wouldn't hire anything but high-class help, and he'd see they got a square deal, too. Say, what's this Grosvenor guy's first name?
Richard.
Richard Grosvenor. How does his wife stand with him?
If you mean, is he in love with Laurel? He is, madly.
Okay. Then Laurel's not the tough baby. Her mother is, eh?
Oh, but Jeff, I would not call Madame Dallas tough.
I mean hard to put something over on. Hard to bluff.
Oh, well, I imagine Laurel has led a more sheltered life than her mother has. And naturally, she's more naive and,
timid.
Cantrell, why are you asking me these questions?
Just curiosity, Rashid. Just curiosity. If you're looking for an ashtray, there's one over on that table.
Oh, thank you. Well, who's the girl in the photograph, Jeff?
Never mind.
Well, surely you're not jealous because I look at her photograph. She's very pretty. Your girl?
She's not my girl.
Oh, no? Then perhaps you would not object to introducing her to me. It may be that I will have better luck
than
you.
That's my sister.
Your sister?
That's right. And you've got about as much chance of meeting her as you have of sprouting wings.
So, you have a sister. You've hidden her very well.
Yeah, and she's going to stay hidden. See?
She has written on the photograph to John from his devoted sister, Evelyn. John? Why does she call you that?
Because that's my name.
Oh, your real name is John Cantrell.
The Cantrell part's phony, too.
Oh, Jeff Cantrell is an alias, and you are really John, John what?
Sometime when you can sleep nights, you might try guessing.
Oh, I begin to understand. The lovely Evelyn does not know Jeff Cantrell, and Jeff Cantrell's friends do not know John X. I should like to meet your lovely sister.
Listen, punk. If you want to be measured for a cloud...
Calm yourself, Jeff. My path is not likely to cross your sister's soon. I leave tomorrow for Florida.
Florida? What are you going to do down there?
Well, I've been invited to, shall I say, work in a gambling casino at one of the smart winter resorts. Why don't you come along, Jeff? We might find something for you, too.
No, Rashid. Sounds too fancy for me. Besides, after what you told me before... I think my plans will include a little trip to Washington pretty soon.
So Jeff Cantrell is planning to go to Washington soon. How will his visit affect Stella and her loved ones? And what of Edmund's decision to settle down in Washington? Don't miss the new developments in our sequel to Stella Dallas on Monday.
Stella Dallas with Sheikh Ahmed. Arnold Moss, you'll never live that one down. That one really goes back. We'll get back to our guest, Arnold Moss, right after a word from our sponsor.
Get growing. Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Yes, you'll grow more with Cromwell Savings because at Cromwell Savings you can count the difference. You'll have to agree that no budget is perfect, and no matter how carefully you handle your finances, sometimes money problems arise. That's where Cromwell Savings comes in. When you need a personal loan for new appliances or just to get your budget back on an even keel, stop in at the Cromwell Savings Bank. You'll find out for yourself at Cromwell Savings. You can really count the difference.
You'll grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where there is plenty of free parking. Cromwell Savings, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is veteran radio, television, motion picture actor Arnold Moss. And while we were listening to that Stella Dallas recording, Arnold, you indicated that your wife wrote some of the Stella Dallas scripts?
Not Stella Dallas. No. That was written by, a lady by the name of Helen Brewer, who is an old friend of ours. My wife wrote John's Other Wife for 5 years, and then she wrote Amanda of Honeymoon Hill for a year and a half, and then she did a lot of special things for the Kate Smith Show and broke a heart every time because they were edited and things.
You weren't married to Elaine Carrington by any chance, were you? Is that who you mean?
No. My wife is Stella Reynolds.
who was the woman in that excerpt we heard?
Well, that was Ann Elsner, who played the role right from the very beginning until the end. Isn't that right?
She now, to the best of my knowledge, I think owns a restaurant somewhere on the river between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, a very famous restaurant.
All right, let's talk about some of the shows that you appeared in. Obviously, the soaps were a way of earning a living, but they probably were not the most gratifying for the radio actor, were they?
But they were. They were indeed, because whether it was John's Other Wife or Merton Marge or Easy Aces or Big Sister, and I did them all. I don't think there was one that I did not do. I also did things like being the announcer for the New York Philharmonic for a couple of years, for being a stooge in a Spanish-speaking or a dialect Spanish-speaking stooge on one of the big shows, for being the narrator on an Archibald MacLeish series about, it was called, I think, The American Story, doing all kinds of things, and they every one of them, aside from the financial aspects of them, FBI and Peace and War, Gangbusters, my gosh, Grand Central Station, all of those. I wrote some of them, too. The one thing that was so wonderful about radio, and I hope present listeners will have a chance to recall this on their own, was that, for my sake, from my point of view, it was the only medium we've ever had that appealed completely to the imagination of the receiver, of the person who was getting it. He built the sets. He did the costumes. When I played in Inner Sanctum, for example, I once played a 400-pound man. I am anything but 400 pounds. But I was able to convince the listener that I was 400 pounds. So that, in a sense, the listener even cast the show. And I know of no medium ever in the whole history of the entertainment world where so much was given to the imagination of the person who was receiving it.
I was on the listening end of radio, and I remember when publicity photos would come out of your favorite shows, and I was constantly disappointed. And these were good-looking men and women, but I was constantly disappointed in their faces, because they weren't my faces.
There was another thing that was very important about it until, excuse me, until after the union stopped, came in and said you could only do so much. We all doubled like crazy on Gangbusters, for example. We would play 6 and 7 parts in a half-hour show, and this called on a facility of technique, not necessarily good, of inventing voices, of inventing characterizations with no rehearsal. You were given the script and you rehearsed for an hour and there you were on the air. And that, from an actor's point of view, kept you very much on your toes. And that was a wonderful thing.
We've heard so many stories, Ed, about how often actors would have to drive in cabs from one studio to another.
Well, I'm sure Arnold went through all that, because you did all the networks, Mutual, CBS, NBC, at that time, didn't you?
Yes, I remember I had two running parts. I think it was Big Sister and the Goldbergs, and one was at CBS, one was at NBC, and I had 4 minutes to get from 52nd Street in Madison over to what is now Radio City. And you'd have elevator men waiting for you, and you'd have cabs waiting for you, and you hoped that it wouldn't snow or rain, and you'd get in there out of breath, gulp and take a deep breath, and go from Reed Bannister to whatever you were playing on the Goldbergs. And we were very busy people, this hardcore of 25 or 30 of us. Everett Sloan, I mean, there were so many of us. And once in an interview like this, I was asked to say how many shows the greatest number of shows I'd ever done in a single week. And I had looked it up in advance. And believe it or not, and we were all doing this kind of thing, there was one period of 7 days in which I was on the air in 41 different shows.
That's incredible.
It's incredible, but I've got the records. 41 different shows in 7 days.
Now, did you get to the point where you would hire someone to stand in for you?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that question. Yes, indeed, because the poor director, you know, he'd only see you at airtime, and he'd say, we can't rehearse. Would you send a stand-in? And you'd send a stand-in, and you'd pay him whatever fees the union said had to be paid. And my favorite stand-in, I was always asked to get somebody whose voice resembled mine and who was a pretty good actor. My favorite stand-in is now a resident of this state, Connecticut, and if you have read the reports in places like Time magazine, you know that he earns a great deal of money by doing voiceovers. His name is Alex Scourby.
Yes, he's been a guest on this program, and he was a stand-in.
Alex was my stand-in.
Well, you certainly picked the best guy available, because he's top of the line today, Alex Scourby.
And another stand-in by the name of Norman Rose, who's doing pretty well, too.
I would think so. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when we interviewed Alex Scourby, he wasn't all that excited about radio. He said, well, it was a medium, you know, and perhaps this fills in the missing page now.
Maybe.
That he was doing the
Maybe.
Stand-in parts
Maybe.
For you.
Maybe.
Well, of all the shows that you did, is there any one that would stand out in your mind? Not necessarily a program in itself, but a performance where something either happened or presented a challenge?
Oh, there were so many of them, but I did a great many of them during the war. I did the burning of the books, the Bene thing, and This Is Your Enemy. I was doing them in bilingually. I was doing them trilingually, as a matter of fact. I was doing them when I was in South America some years ago. I found that they still have tapes and records down there of what were the names of these things? They were all being translated into Spanish, and I was doing them in Spanish as well as in English. And then I did them in French, too.
Well, was this with Aldo Gazalbert by any chance? Because Aldo Gazalbert, he was doing that same thing at that time.
No, this was with Carlos Montalban, and this was for the coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, Nelson Rockefeller. And it was Las ideas no se matan, and hacia un mundo mejor. And they were all anti-Nazi and pro-democratic propaganda, so as to keep the South Americans on our side. And this, I think that whole spate of 3 or 4 years in there, when you were called on to do everything that you could to, I think the expression is, help the war effort, were terribly exciting. One of the most exciting things I ever did, and it's a long story, and I'll try to say it in 3 sentences, I was sort of kidnapped once by one of these agencies and put on a plane. I didn't know where, and in the middle of the night I was taken to a place where they were building airplane parts to send to Britain. And at 4 in the morning, it was in the neighborhood of Cincinnati, I discovered. I was brought to WLW. And here was an orchestra of 60 men and actors and everything else to narrate a film on the war effort. This was at the very beginning of the war. Where is Joe so-and-so? Oh, he was in Bataan and that kind of thing. This factory had been built in 6 months in what had been fields. And here were kids who had been working in Woolworths 6 months before, turning out complicated airplane parts. This was one of the most thrilling things that ever happened to me in radio.
I can imagine it would be. And it's about time we heard Arnold Moss again.
Well, you mentioned this show already, and it's one of my favorites, and it stands up today. That's Gangbusters. And this is the Park Avenue Pilferers, this particular episode. And I think before they were on the air, you had a few good ones because you were slightly inebriated at the start of the show, at least in character, not in real life. So, you remember that show at all, any chance?
Not that particular one, but I may remember it if you play it.
Now, Gangbusters, presented in cooperation with police and federal law enforcement departments throughout the United States. The only national program that brings you authentic police case histories.
Now, to tonight's drama.
Tonight, Gangbusters presents the case of the Park Avenue Pelferers. The burglar king and queen who looted New York City's most luxurious apartments, but have finally got stuck on a dab of wine.
Gangbusters has asked the Honorable John J. Sullivan, former chief of detectives and deputy commissioner, New York City Police Department, to narrate by proxy tonight's case. Welcome back to Gangbusters, Chief Sullivan.
Thank you, Don Gardner. Suppose we begin in New York City a few years ago. It was after 4 o'clock in the morning, and the lobby of one of the city's most fashionable Park Avenue hotels was deserted, except for the housemen who were busy cleaning the floors and furniture. The handsome but slightly tipsy young man in top hat and white tie who walked across the lobby toward the desk didn't distract the workers. They had seen too many of the type.
One side, peasants, one side. Make way for the king. Make way for the king. Clear the king's highway. The key of the royal bedchamber, if you please.
Good morning, Mr. Carr.
Hey, my key, if you please.
Yes, sir. 432, please.
The royal bedchamber.
I'm sorry, Mr. Carr. There's no key in the box.
No key? Well, that's perfectly ridiculous, man. There must be a key.
Perhaps, sir, your wife took them both upstairs with her by mistake.
Ah, you have hit the solution. I shall reward you handsomely. But it wasn't by mistake. queen merely wants to see at what time the king arrives home from his rendezvous with a dancing girl.
That appears to be the answer, Mr. Carr.
And I shall pound upon the door with the fury of a Henry seeking entrance to the boudoir of Anne Boleyn. Good night, my loyal vassal.
Oh, Mr. Carr, you speak? Perhaps I could send a bellman up with a passkey.
Ah, a noble plan. I'll reward you twofold.
Front boy.
We shall foil the plot of the wicked queen. See? One of my grenadiers in uniform approaches.
Ah, yes, sir. Boy, take the passkey up and let Mr. Carr into 432.
Ah, yes, sir. After you, sir.
Oh, I am not above my offices. We shall walk arm in arm.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
watch it, sir. Watch it.
Rough terrain.
Kind of a rough night, too, huh?
Rough. Absolutely wild.
Mm. Now, watch your step getting from the elevator there.
Yes, I shall reward you handsomely also.
Four.
Handsome chariot. Rise, rise, rise to the heights.
Yeah, only to the fourth floor, sir.
Oh, well, well spoken, lad.
Mm, I know. You shall reward me twofold.
Tenfold.
Okay, King, let's go. In yon direction, King.
You know, it's a wonder how I can feel so good and so bad all at the same time.
Well, it's no wonder to me, King.
We approach.
Okay.
Try the key gently, lest we awaken the queen.
Mm. She's got the double lock on, Kingy. You're out of luck. Okay.
Ah, ha, ha. Bully, lad, bully.
Okay, watch your step, King. I'll get the light.
A noble gesture, my...
Uh-oh. The queen is in the parlor.
Well, Andrew, are you dressed to go out tonight or last night?
We're just out for a walk around the block, my dear. Oh, excuse me.
Andrew!
Oh, how do you like that?
Do something.
Well, he's only passed out, lady.
Do something quickly.
He's got to sleep at all.
Oh, Andrew, speak to me.
He'll be all right.
Run and get some ice cream.
Yeah, but, lady,
run and get some ice.
All right, then. He'll be okay. Don't worry.
Andrew, speak to me. Speak to me.
Hi, baby.
Like a child.
Did you leave the key in the door?
Yeah.
Grab it fast.
Any trick, Andy?
For the wax, got it. Let's get busy. Got about a minute to make an impression of that key before he gets back. 50 grand. This ought to be good for it. At least 50 grand.
That was a real neat trick, Andy.
Talent, baby, talent. That's all it takes.
Hello?
Lieutenant Hanson?
Yeah?
Well, this is Will.
Will?
You know, we're bellhop at the Park Edge.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry if I woke you, but you said call any time, so I'm calling.
That's all right, Will. What's up?
I think I got some information for you, Lieutenant.
Oh?
Yeah. I think a guy registered here got a wax impression of the passkey. The key looked like it had some wax left on it. Shall I light a match to it?
No, we'll take care of that. You know who it was, Will?
Yeah, a guy named Andrew Carr in 432. He's supposed to be from Chicago. He looked like a phony to me. The minute I saw him, he looked phony.
All right, Will, just take it easy. Just tell me what happened.
Well, he walks into the lobby a little after four, loaded, see? Or making like he was loaded. Mm-hmm. He walks up to the desk and asks for his key. But there's no key in the box, see? So the clerk gets the passkey and has me take
him. Andy, you finished shaving?
Yeah, baby.
Breakfast here. I poured the coffee.
Oh, I'm ready. What a life. Room service, class galore.
Well, it's hard to be good at $20 a day.
Well, every enterprise has got to have its investment, baby. This one will pay off. Caught the cherry off my grapefruit.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hate to leave this comfort. Oh, takes this grapefruit.
Then we're checking out today?
Well, we got what we came after, didn't we? This trip, I mean. That little piece of wax is worth 50 grand at least, past the showroom.
Mm. Yeah.
After breakfast, I want you to take that wax down to Harry and let him make up the key.
Okay.
Then we'll try it on our door here before we check out. You know, it's too bad, baby.
What's too bad?
Too bad we just can't back a truck up to the hotel As long as we're going to clean the place out, we might as well do a good job.
Oh, honest, Andy. Aren't you ever satisfied?
Satisfied? We're on a gravy train, baby. Nobody ever had a sweeter racket.
Well, I think we just ought to enjoy things a little bit.
What's the matter?
Aren't you enjoying yourself now? Breakfast in your room? What else do you want?
They only have to get us once. That's all. Just once.
Don't worry about it, baby. It gives you wrinkles. How could it be safer? Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Carr of Chicago check out today. The hotel forgets about us. In a couple of weeks, if a few of the suites here are burglarized, nobody gets a connection. Well, eggs on a wren. Now, isn't that a nice way to start the day?
Lieutenant Hanson. Oh, hello, Chief. Well, I'd say it looks pretty good. We put a surveillance on the... Oh, come in, Ryan. Ryan, just walk in, Chief. If anything looks hot, I'll call you back. So long.
Hi, boss.
That was the chief calling from downtown.
He's anxious, huh?
Well, after about 50 apartment house and hotel room burglaries, wouldn't you be anxious, too?
I am anxious. But I won't be for long.
You think they're right, huh?
Right is a two-story flat in Elmer.
Good, let's have it.
They're registered under the names of Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Carr, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I call Chicago. There's no such address as the one they give on Michigan Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
He stayed in the room this morning, and she went out. I put Adler to following her.
And?
The lady went over to Lexington Avenue, down into the subway station, took the local to Grand Central, and changed for an express. She got off at Canal Street and went upstairs. She turned the corner into Lafayette, went into a hardware store. A hardware store owned by one Harry Nelson.
Anything on Nelson?
The safe and loft squad knows him. He did 2 to 5 in Sing Sing for unlawful entry.
Hmm.
Picked up 4 times on suspicion of receiving since. Each case dismissed in felony court for want of evidence.
You think friend Harry is making the pass keys from the wax mold?
I'd venture a guess.
Did she wait for the key?
Apparently not. She wasn't in there more than 5 minutes. As soon as Adler called me, I sent Sherman down to maintain a surveillance of the hardware store.
What about the girl?
She hopped in a cab and went to Saks Fifth Avenue. Adler stayed right behind her. She took the elevator to the beauty parlor where she now reposes.
And Adler?
He reposes there, too. He just phoned me. The girl's a regular customer of the Saks beauty parlor. She's known to them as Mrs. Mona Davis of 1642 Buchanan Avenue, the Bronx, from which address she has a charge account, pays her bills regularly.
All right, send somebody to take over from Adler.
Okay.
I want him to check around that Bronx address.
Okay, boss. Well, looks like we got a line on the right people, huh?
Maybe.
Maybe. What are they doing checked into the hotel with a phony name and a phony Chicago address? What if you visit a shady hardware guy for it? All adds up?
Yeah. Keep them under surveillance, Ryan. We can't walk in on these people and arrest them for burglary with just this to go on. You've got to nail them with some of the goods on them, otherwise we've got no case.
Okay, boss. Hey, that's a pretty smart kid, this bellhop, huh?
Oh, yes, yes. That reminds me of something I want to do.
What?
I want to see the manager of that hotel again. I want to see if we can get a few of our people onto the staff there for a couple of days. They might not try to use that pass key for a few weeks, but I want somebody on the inside just in case. Come on, let's go.
Right with you, boss.
That sounds like a great story. I wish we could hear all of it. I'd like to find out how it ends, but we can't, unfortunately. We'll get back to our guest, Arnold Moss, right after this message from our sponsor.
Get growing, get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Need an auto loan? See the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank. Cromwell Savings will help you purchase that new car quickly and easily. And if a personal loan is what you want, they can arrange that too. In fact, Cromwell Savings can help with all your financial needs because they're a complete family banking service. So before you take that important financial step in your life, see the friendly, accommodating folks at Cromwell Savings Bank. Main and West Streets, Cromwell. Convenient banking by mail available.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
The Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC. Plenty of free parking, open Thursdays till 5, Fridays till 7:30 p.m. You're attuned to the sound of service, WTIC Hartford, where there's more good listening than ever before. On future Golden Age of Radio shows, you'll meet such personalities as Arnold Stang, Mel Blanc, Robert Cummings, Elliot Lewis, as well as the author of the new book titled The Soaps, David Rounds. And now, back to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran, and tonight's special guest, Arnold Moss.
Gangbusters, of course, was produced by Phillips H. Lord, and we have been told by people like Larry Haynes and so on that Mr. Lord would cast you visually. Did you ever have that experience with him?
I think so. I don't remember in detail, but possibly he did.
Larry said that he had to literally walk into his office with a slouched hat and a cigarette dangling from his lips. And of course, Larry Haynes is not that type at all.
No, Lord was a character in his own right. Incidentally, I played a great many of the heavies in radio, and I got killed regularly 4 or 5 times a week. And when these things were happening, my son was then about 2.5 years old, and he would listen. And we had a nurse at the time taking care of Jeff, and she would tell my wife to get me immediately before I left the station to call home to assure Jeff that I was all right, that I really hadn't been killed.
He managed to make it all right, didn't he?
My son?
Yeah.
Well, he's managed to make it all right in lots of other fields because since... You mean as an adult?
I mean as going through this traumatic experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. It maybe has left marks on him, but he became head writer of Sesame Street, and he's got 2 Emmys and a Grammy and a gold record and 6 books and 4 albums, and he's doing all right.
I wouldn't worry about him. Speaking of writing, you said that you did some writing and that you'd like to do some more radio writing.
Oh, yes. I started with my wife until I got into a play and I had to say, okay, it's all yours. Started writing Aunt Jenny's True Life Stories. Have you got one of those, Ed? we started to write some of those, and I played in a great many of them with Dan Seymour announcing them, who is the head of the big ad agency, whose name, even if I could remember, I suppose I shouldn't say. We wrote some of those. We wrote a lot of the Inner Sanctums for High Brown. We wrote Grand Central Station. She wrote the Kate Smith things. And when I get through here at UConn and have a couple of weeks of rest, I've outlined a couple of shows for High Brown for the Mystery Theater that I'd love to write just for the joy of writing them as I do my crossword puzzles for the New York Times. I don't know if you know about that.
No, I don't know about that.
Well, you know, the Sunday magazine of the New York Times has the big crossword puzzle. I've had about 10 of them in the last 5-6 years. And the big 50th anniversary of the Simon & Schuster crossword puzzle book, edited by Margaret Farah, who invented the darn thing. They're holding a party next week, and I can't go there because I'm here. And somebody said, do you get paid very much for that? And I figured it out. For 5 months' work, it takes me about 5 months to do one of the big ones, you get paid $90. That's something like 4 cents a week. No, you don't do it for pay. You do it for fun and relaxation.
The opportunity to interview a radio writer has never presented itself before, Ed.
No, it's really a real treat, and I'm glad you're going to submit some new scripts because we talked about this, how, you know, I think some newer ones would make the show a lot better, you know, more modern scripts than what he's been using.
I'm curious to know, how long would it take you to write a good radio script?
I don't know how long it would take me now because I'm very out of practice. I don't know how long it would take my wife to write one because she did more of them than I did. She would sit there in our apartment on East 28th Street with a little boy waiting when she was doing John's Other Wife. There had to be 14 pages, and when the time the 14th page came out of the typewriter, the boy took the 14 pages away up to the office to be mimeoed because they were on the air the next day. This was instant radio, and there was no chance to think about them, to rewrite them. You had to think about them as you did it. How long it would take to write an hour script, I really couldn't answer, Ed. I don't know. It depends on how well the wheels are greased at the moment and whether things are working or not. I am a very careful writer, and I edit all the time as I write. Turn out an hour script might take me, after having thought it out very carefully and written myself an outline, I might be able to do it in 3 or 4 days. But there's a man by the name of Ian Martin, whom you should interview if you haven't, who lives down in Westport and in New York, who's already turned out about 24, 25 of the scripts for Mystery Theater.
Really?
Yeah.
That really is.
That
is an exceptional.
This is 45 or 50 type pages.
Mm-hmm. All right. when you're working against a deadline, that's one thing, I guess, that would push you along. I'm curious, did you ever write for yourself? In other words, did you cast yourself in the role?
Oh, yes. I've got long... None of the I guess they're 78s. I've got some recordings of things that I wrote for a series on NBC in which I was starred, which I wrote for myself. And I've got one or two of them around. I can't play them because they were recorded in a funny way. Laterally? Is it a lateral recording of some kind? You need a special machine for
That's unfortunate. I'm sure Ed could come up with a way of playing it somehow, some way, though.
We take a shot at it if you could give us the recordings.
Well, I will. I'll send it to you. I'd be delighted.
At any rate,
Henry Danko wrote one of them that I've got. You know, Henry Danko, who's won all kinds of prizes for his screenplays and his stage plays. The night my son was being born, I was on the air on Columbia Workshop in a Henry Danko script. And this is 31 years ago. And I've still got it, but I can't play it because it's on this kooky kind of recording thing.
You did indicate that you did play comedy. Did you play much comedy? Did you enjoy it?
Oh, on the air, you mean? Well, I've played comedy in theater. They're playing a movie here tomorrow night in which I played comedy with Bob Cummings. And, you know, I've done things like Malvolio, which are comedy, which is comedy. I loved playing comedy, and because it's so much harder. The challenge is so much greater. And then when I, on stage, played a thing like Walter Burns in the first revival of The Front Page, I learned so much from the toughest guys in the world. These were all nightclub comics that I was playing with, like Lou Parker and Benny Baker and Pat Harrington Sr. And I would say to one of them, "Why don't I get a laugh on that line?" Charlie MacArthur said, "That's a funny line." And he'd say, "Because you're turning 2 inches too much that way." And I'd say, "If I don't turn that 2 inches, I'll get the laugh." And he'd say, "Sure, try it." I'd try it, and they were absolutely right 100% of the time. And in radio, the challenge was even greater because there was no question of turning 2 inches. You had to do it all with one instrument, your voice, and nothing else.
Mm. Radio, of course, is back with High Brown and the Mystery Theater, and we'll have to wait and watch to see whether it's going to work or not. But aside from the fact that you're a part of it, are you glad to see radio as an entertainment medium return?
I think it's wonderful, and it used to be the thing that the housewives used to leave on in the daytime while they were doing other things because they could go from room to room and it didn't matter. With the television soaps, now they're not all that ambulatory. They got to stay in one place. But now that it's coming back at an hour like 7 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night, where you can either in the automobile or at home just turn out the lights and listen to it. All those lights out things that Arch Obler did, I did almost every one of them. I think I was on every program that Corwin ever did, that Bill Robeson ever did. If some of these things were brought back as they were done in the first place, I think they would make just as stimulating and exciting entertainment right today as they did 25, 30 years ago.
I'm sure of that because the good radio drama that we've had the opportunity to hear from Ed's collection stands up. Some of it, some of the not-so-good radio drama, some of the hack writing that did occur at that time, of course, is obviously dated. Let's give Arnold Moss the opportunity that we give most of our guests on this program, Ed.
Yes, would you give us one of your favorite shows, and let's see whether we can play it for you. Anything that you recall from the days, you know, Grand Central or one of those that you were familiar with and you'd like to hear again?
Not necessarily anything that you appeared in. Something that you enjoyed as a radio listener, and I'm sure you did listen to radio as well as work in the field. Does anything come to mind? And I'll bet it's Jack Benny, because every time we ask this question, they say, "Jack Benny."
No. What I would like to hear, if it's possible, if it's around, is to hear one of those original March of Time things where we were all imitating Roosevelt, Mussolini, Hitler, and doing it, I think, pretty well.
Is that possible, then?
I'll try. I have an early one, and it may fit the bill. But that goes way back to the early 30s, what you refer to. Right? I do have one in the mid-30s. Maybe that'll help.
Well, no, that would be it. When Bill Adams, rest his soul, used to do Roosevelt before Carney ever did it, and he was just magnificent. Ted DeCorsia used to do Mussolini. I did them all in Spanish. And those were some very exciting things. Aggie Moorhead used to do Mrs. Roosevelt. Be wonderful if you could dig up one of those.
The March of Time. Time, the weekly news magazine, takes you to the war front and the home front. To bring you news in the making, the people who make the news, and the men and women of Time magazine who report the news. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Westbrook Van Voorhis speaking for the editors of Time magazine.
The voice of Westbrook Van Voorhis and the March of Time, back to the mid-1930s. We'll talk more with our guest, Arnold Moss, right after this message from our sponsor.
With summer about a few weeks away, the Cromwell Savings Bank suggests that this is an excellent time for you to stop in and chat with them about a home improvement loan. This is the time of year when you should consider remodeling your home. With warm weather, you might add a screened porch or a patio. You could even plan to vacation at home with a new swimming pool. A home improvement loan from Cromwell Savings Bank can put in a driveway, improve the landscaping, or put a new roof or coat of paint on your house. Whatever your home improvement needs, the understanding folks at Cromwell Savings Bank can help you with the financing. Pay them a visit soon. Cromwell Savings Bank, open Monday through Wednesday 9 to 3, Thursdays 9 to 5, and Saturdays from 9 a.m. until 7:30 p.m. for your banking convenience. The Cromwell Savings Bank is located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell, Connecticut. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender.
Arnold Moss, it's been great getting together with you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Golden Age of Radio. This series would not be complete without an appearance by you.
Dick, all I can say is that I now feel 30 years younger because you've put me back 30 years, and that's something to be desired all the time. Thank you.
I guess. Until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you tonight by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, headquarters for personal loans, conveniently located on Main Street in Cromwell. Tonight's program was edited by Bob Girego and produced by Dick Bertel.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.